Okay, so first of all, hello everyone. I'm Giuseppe. We all saw each other, I think. If you didn't see me at the meetings, I've been sending you a bunch of emails. I didn't tell you much about myself, so I'll just tell you something now. My interest is mathematical physics and specifically things that have to do with groups. So this course is perfect. Other than physics, things that I do are play music. You can see some of my instruments there in the background. And I also make comics. I have actually an online comic that I've not been updating in a long time. So if you're interested, I'm sure you can easily find it by just Googling my name and comic next to it. And Ivan, who's one of the students at Perimeter Institute, is going to be assisting with symmetries in the afternoon. So hi, Ivan. Let's go over to, first of all, the plan for this lecture. What we're going to do today is figure out what the symmetry is, the main question behind this whole course, which is called symmetries. And we're trying to connect these things with groups. And after that, we're just going to go through a crash course in group theory. We're going to essentially try to go through everything that we need about groups for the rest of the courses. Not everything about groups, but just what we need. The activities are going to include some GeoGebra simulations that we're going to do together. We're going to be brainstorming what is a symmetry, so we're going to think of that together. And then there's going to be a breakout rooms in which we're going to be working on problems in groups. Just one note, these slides I'm going to be writing on. I'll show you in a moment, so don't worry about that. So I'll tell you where to find them, but I posted in the Google Drive the blank slides, so the ones without my writing on top, so you can at least see the things that I have already. Some of the definitions I'm going to be using are already there, so you have them for later reference. And at some point later today, I'll just upload everything that I'm writing. So if you're missing something, don't worry, all these things are going to be online. Okay, so first of all, this is the Google Drive folder. You should all have access to this. The link is in one of the emails I sent you. So this is going to be our folder. It's publicly accessible. First of all, I wanted to go over the course outline and then I'll show you where the things are. So just quickly, hopefully you read this already, but the aim of this course is to go over some of the many ways in which symmetries play a role in physics. There's a lot of them. We cannot do everything. So for the most part, what we're going to try to do is describe symmetries in terms of groups. And we're going to see the difference between continuous symmetries, infinitesimal symmetries, discrete symmetries. We're going to talk about Noether's theorem, and that's the classical physics part. For the remainder of the course, we'll deal with quantum theory, and we'll see that Lie groups and the algebras play a fundamental role in quantum theory, both in general and in description of symmetries. I'm going to try to have roughly the same amount of lecture time and activities during each of these lectures. You can read the rest for yourself. And there's a tentative course schedule that we'll see if things are actually going according to plan. Now, for the lecture material, give me a moment because everything is frozen here. I think my camera is frozen. Okay, so I'll try to fix my camera in the meantime. If you go inside lecture material, lecture one, you're going to find the empty slides that you can look at as needed. There's more than we're probably going to cover, depending on when we have to end. There's a file with the exercises. So when I ask you to go into the breakout rooms, you're not going to be able to see my screen anymore, but you can access this file to see what the exercises are. And here there's a bunch of links. So I'm going to send you these links anyway through the Zoom chat. But this morning, some people were not able to open links in the Zoom chat. So in case you are not able to, you just go on this file and open the link from there. Okay. Let's see if I can get my camera to work. Okay, I'm back. Okay, so next, want to try to make these lectures as interactive as possible, considering the constraints that we are in a virtual classroom. So first of all, this class is a virtual safe space. Any questions are welcome. It doesn't matter if you think they're trivial, they're not trivial, or questions are good. Please ask anytime you have any question. Now, and I'm never going to make you feel like your questions are bad. That's a promise. If I break this promise, you are free to just turn on your mics and all yell at me at the same time. You have a few options on how you want to ask these questions. One thing you can do is just raise your hand through Zoom, pressing the appropriate button, and then we're going to unmute you and you can ask in person. And Ivan is going to be monitoring this thing because I'm probably not going to notice them since I'm writing on the slides, but it's going to make sure that you're not missed. And the other option is you can use the Zoom chat. So just send a message in the Zoom chat. You can either send it to everyone and then it's not anonymous, or if you want it to be anonymous, if you don't want everyone to see your question, please send the question directly to Ivan. If you send it to me, there's a good chance I'm going to miss it because I'm not going to be looking at the chat all the time. So if you want it to be anonymous, please send it to Ivan. Now, the next option is using Slido. You should already be familiar with it because we used it last Thursday at the meeting, but you can just go to slido.do or do, however you want to say it, and enter this as the room number. Also, you can use the link that I'm just going to send you right now. Let me find my file with the links. Okay, so you can find this link both in the Google Doc that I showed you before, or I'll just send it to you through Zoom. Okay, so if you open this link, you're going to end up here. So you can ask questions here, and someone already asked a question. This one was a question from me from this morning. So you can just type questions here if you want. Now, I do suggest you use the Zoom chat instead so we can stay inside Zoom and you don't have to open an external thing, but if you want to, you can ask questions here and Ivan is going to be monitoring this and let me know when there are questions. So let's start with answering these questions. Are we going to talk about manifold test question? I may mention them. You don't need to know what manifolds are. When we get to Lie groups, technically Lie groups are also manifolds. If you have no idea what I'm talking about, that's fine. Don't worry, we're going to be covering these things. You don't need to know manifolds and we're not going to really cover manifolds. So if you know them already, I'm going to make the connections with manifolds. If you don't know them, I'm just going to explain things in a way that we don't need to talk about manifolds. And another thing is that I will often ask you questions during the lectures. It would be great if you could answer instead of having just me stay at the screen waiting. I do not know how this is going to work online because we're using a different format. I've never done this before, just once this morning. So I don't know how well we're going to be able to do things, but we're still going to try. Now, when I ask questions, again, you have a couple of options. You can raise your hand and answer in person. You can use the Zoom chat to answer. And often I'm just going to use Slido or something similar to ask you the question. So you can just answer directly there and we're going to not have any problems. Okay, so before we go on, are there any questions? That's my first question to you. Okay, I'm going to assume that's a no, but if you have questions at any time, just put them in the chat. You're not interrupting. Ivan is just going to let me know about the question whenever he thinks it's a good time to stop me. So just ask questions whenever they pop in your mind and they can be answered a couple of minutes later if needed. Okay, so the first thing we're going to do is actually an activity. I wanted to answer a poll because I want to get an idea of how much you know about group theory and representation theory already. So to do this, you're going to go to this website, socreative.com, and go to login as a student. I'll show you how it's done in a moment. And the room name is Symmetries. You don't need an account, just the room name is going to be Symmetries for the rest of the course. Luckily, no one else called the room Symmetries, so we got this one. So if you want to do this, just go to Socrati.com. And actually, now that I think of it, I need to stop the previous activity. So if you find something already there, don't do anything, because that's another activity that you should not be doing yet. So let me stop the first. Okay, so you go to login, student login. Symmetries, it doesn't care about upper or lowercase. And this is what you're going to find, unless I start the activity, which I'm going to be doing in a moment. Okay, so now as you can see, you're going to be greeted with this question. I want to know how familiar you are with group theory, and then I'm going to ask about representation theory. And you don't need to know anything about these things. I just want to get an idea so that I can adjust my lectures if needed. And I can actually show you what the questions are so you get an idea. Okay, so a few people still have to answer, but it looks like it's pretty evenly distributed. So some people know a little bit about group theory, roughly the same amount of people don't know much about group theory, and the same amount of people who know very much about group theory and don't know anything about group theory. So it evens out perfectly. So it means that my lectures are not useless, which is great. Hopefully by the end of this course, some of your best friends are going to be groups for all of you. And about representation theory, same thing. So again, no knowledge of these things is needed at all. I'm going to be teaching you everything that we need to know about both representation theory and group theory. Okay, so I'm going to end this because we don't have a lot of time. Okay, so what we're going to do next is figure out what the symmetry is. And actually, something else that I wanted to tell you and I forgot, regarding your cameras, you can have them on or off, it's completely up to you. If you are comfortable with having them on, it will help me a lot, because at least I can see people instead of just a screen, and it feels a bit more like a real lecture. But of course, if you don't want to be seen, that's also fine. So completely up to you. Okay, so what is a symmetry? Rather than me trying to tell you what the symmetry is, we're going to brainstorm this thing. Before we do that, I'll show you something just to give us an idea what the symmetry is, and then we'll start the brainstorming. Okay, so now this is GeoGebra. If you want to, you can install the software and then you can find the files in the Google Drive folder and open them on your computer. If you don't want to do that, that's fine. There's an online version of the software. I'm going to send you the link in the Zoom chat, and you can find it in the Google Doc with all the links. So you can just open directly the online version. It just requires a browser and it's going to work. And now I suggest you open it now, because you can actually see what's happening. This thing is interactive, so you can move the sliders on your own and see what happens. So I really encourage you to do that. And actually, this is one way that online lectures are better than in class, because in class, I will not be able to do this. I will just be moving things. You cannot interact with it, but now you can. Okay, so here's the link. Okay, so you might have recognized what this is already. This is the golden spiral. Also, there's a golden spiral title on top of this window. Now, the golden spiral is related to Fibonacci numbers and the golden ratio. We're not going to go there, but that's all encoded in this number B here. For our purposes, this is just a spiral of this form. It's all the set of points that satisfy these equations, with B some real number, which has a special meaning, and theta any real number. So this is actually an infinite spiral. It goes all the way to zero and it just gets bigger and bigger and continues going. Now these two sliders encode rotations and scalings. I just did things so that when we move epsilon, the scale factor is e to the 2 pi b epsilon, just for convenience. Otherwise, the numbers get huge. And t is such that the angle that we're rotating by is 2 pi t. So as you move this thing around, notice that I put some objects that are auxiliary. You can take them off if you want, just so that it looks like we are actually increasing or decreasing the zoom level. So something to notice is that as we zoom in, the spiral kind of has the same feature. And in fact, if epsilon is an integer, it just gets back to itself. And that's one of the ideas that we want for symmetries. We're doing something, but we're getting the object to actually stay the same. The spiral doesn't care if you zoom by the right amount, it stays the same, while all the other objects are going to be zoomed out. On the other end, the rotations, if they are multiples of 2 pi, keep everything invariant, which is kind of obvious. So you may wonder, why do I even put the rotations here? Well, notice that rotating from the point of view of the spiral, if I rotate or if I scale, it's kind of the same idea. Scaling is a rotation for the spiral. And I leave it up to you to check what happens if you link both sliders and move things at the same time. So you're going to notice something interesting about this. We may go over these things again at some point in the future. Okay, so at this point, we're going to start brainstorming. So based on these concepts, what we want to find out is some kind of definition of a symmetry. It doesn't have to be mathematical, just some idea of what is a symmetry. Someone asked you, what's a symmetry? What would you tell them? And now to do this, we're going to use Slido. So I'm going to start the activity. Actually, wait, I need to reset the numbers. Okay, so you're going to see in polls, there's what is a symmetry, you can type in your answer. And we can all see what's happening. Okay, so all of these questions so far are after invariant or invariance in the definition, which is good. Okay, actually, what I'm going to do is show you this screen. Otherwise, they're going to be cut off. And you can already see what the next question is going to be, but pretend you don't see what's here. Okay, so it seems like from what I can see that most of your answers are something, is some transformation or some operation, something that has to be properly defined that leaves something invariant. That seems to be what this is about. It's all about invariance, which makes sense. So these are all great answers. And now let's try to put together something. I'll tell you what I think. A definition that kind of fits all of these things, but it's vague enough to work in general is. Now, one thing to notice is, and trust me, I tried to do it because I was preparing a course about symmetries. We cannot really give a mathematical definition of symmetry that's going to fit every possible thing, because it really depends on the particular example we're working on. So in some cases, symmetry means something. In another case, it may mean something else. So examples, I'm going to give you in a moment. But let me define this thing. So a symmetry is a transformation of, I'm going to call it A, it's just something that has to be defined that leaves B, which is something else, invariant. Now, this is an extremely vague definition, but at least it's going to be applicable in a wide range of cases. So the idea is that these A and B don't have to be the same thing. Maybe the same thing. B may be something that lives in A, or something completely different. So some examples. For the spiral, we call that B is the spiral and A is the plane. The transformation I did earlier was a transformation that we do to the plane. When I did the rotation or the zooming, I was zooming in or rotating the whole R2, and the spiral, which is a subset of R2, was left invariant. So that's a geometrical concept of a symmetry. At the same time, another example is if you have an action which is the integral of a Lagrangian, and we're going to see this next lecture, then a symmetry is something that lives. This is more complicated, but in this case, B, for example, could be time. So we could do a transformation in time, such as time translation. Sorry, that would be A. So we are transforming time, and B is the action itself. So in this case, time and the action are not really related. Time is not something that the action lives in, like in the geometrical case. But we can still define a symmetry as something that lives something else invariant. So we can transform one thing and another thing is left invariant. Are there any questions about this? Any comments on anyone else? Okay, as usual, feel free to ask if you have any questions. Okay, so there are a few properties that we want symmetries to have. Some of them are just things that we notice. Some other things are things that we really want them to have. So the first thing is that nothing, in quotes, should be a symmetry. Now, this sentence doesn't really mean anything. What I mean by nothing is doing nothing. So maybe I should add that. So it becomes actually a sentence. So doing nothing should be a symmetry. I said that the symmetry is a transformation of something that leaves something else invariant. If a transformation is take whatever we are working on and don't do anything to it, then this should be a symmetry because it leaves everything invariant. Nothing is affected by it. So we want to have an identity symmetry. Now, this thing is something that we like, not necessarily that we need, but we want to be able to undo symmetries. These symmetries are transformation. We want them to be invertible. Now, the reason why is that we want to only consider things that don't destroy information. If you have a transformation that destroys information, we cannot revert it back because we're losing some information. And we don't want that to happen for our symmetries. It is just a requirement that we require this thing. There's absolutely no reason why this has to happen. You could have a transformation of R2 that leaves the spiral to itself, but it takes two random points and puts them in the same place, and then you cannot undo the transformation. And in some sense, there's still a symmetry because it leaves the spiral invariant, but we don't really like it because it destroys information in the process. And now finally, we want to be able to compose symmetries. And the idea here is if you have two transformations that both leave B invariant, then if you do one transformation and then you do another, B should stay invariant because it stayed the same the first time and now you do something that leaves it the same. And because we're using things that are transformations as functions, we have a notion of composing things. So we want this to work. So these are the things that describe symmetries. And if you know group theory already, these look like the axioms of group theory. If you don't, I'm going to tell it to you in a second. Okay, so remember, if you have any questions, you can always ask at any time. Okay, so what is a group? Now, this is a mathematical definition, which does not really necessarily have to do anything with symmetries. The definition is something that tries to identify a certain structure. From our points of view, we're going to pretend that we're defining this exactly to give us what we like about symmetries. So a group is some set G with an operation. Now this operation can be denoted in a lot of ways. I'm going to use star here when we have an arbitrary operation. And it has to have this special property. So first of all, notice that the operation takes two elements of G. So it takes a pair of group elements and sends them to another one. So it's something that you feed it two group elements, spits out another one. It's also called a binary operation. Okay, so we need to have a special one, which you call the identity, that satisfies this. We denote it by E, which probably comes from German about how to say identity, like many things in math. So we need to satisfy G times E or G star E equals E star G equals G. So it doesn't matter if we have E on the right or on the left. When we use the operation with another group element, it leaves it unchanged. If it behaves like this, we call it the identity. And this is going to be the equivalent of our identity transformation. So when we make a group out of symmetries, the identity is the one that doesn't do anything. Now we want to be able to invert things. So each element is going to have an inverse, something that when you multiply it or you use the operation star, is going to send you to the identity. And it doesn't matter if you act on the left or on the right, it should give you the identity. So every element has an inverse. And finally, now this is just a technical requirement. The operation star is associative, which means that if you have A star B star C, you can either do B and C first and then multiply by A, or you do A and B first, then multiply by C. It should not affect the result. And something to note is that for composition of functions, we have F composed G composed H equals F composed G composed H. Which means because our group elements are symmetries, this thing is very important because we want to be able to have those properties and the symmetries are going to have them. If they are functions, then they are going to be associative because it's how composition of function works. Now, one last thing, we say that the group is either abelian or commutative. They're interchangeable terms. We just call them whatever you want, depending on how we like to say it, if this happens. For any pair of elements A and B, it doesn't matter if you do A times B or B times A, it ends up being the same. Okay, so some information about notation. We often use A, B for A star B. If there is no ambiguity on which operation we're working on, we just write it with juxtaposition and we just write A, B without anything in between, just because it's easier and we're used to it. It's what you do with multiplication of real numbers, for example. No one ever writes the dot in between unless you have two numbers, 2 times 3. And if you write them without anything, it becomes 23. So that's one thing. And the other thing is technically the group is a pair So the group is really the pair G, comma, star. Just that we're lazy and we often just say G is the group. So we're going to do that most of the time. We're going to use these when there may be confusion. And that happens, for example, when you have a set that can have more than one operation on it. And then it's not clear which one you're using and you specify it. Okay, so at this point, we're going to start another brainstorming session. And what I want to know right now is, do you know already some examples of groups? If you do, or you can think of one based on the definitions I gave, just write it in the Slido poll. I want to start it right now. Okay, there's SUN. The dihedral group, complex numbers. Okay, there's a lot of Greek groups in here. Okay, so a lot of you already know many examples of what we're going to find out are Lie groups, since they're appearing here. Let me see if I post this. You cannot see it anymore. Okay, so I'm going to stop here because we have lots of things to do. But there's lots of great examples in here. I'm going to write down some of these in the notes. And if you saw these things and you have no idea what's happening again, don't worry. That's perfectly fine. We're going to cover groups. We're going to see many of these things, especially the Lie groups, in later lectures. Okay, so some examples are, for example, I saw Z plus. So really, we can use as example, and this is where the notation is important. We can have Z plus, which means Z with addition, or we can have R with addition, or we can have C with addition. Really any number set you want with addition, they're all groups. And in fact, they are a billion groups. And for these particular groups, the identity element is actually going to be zero. And we're going to have that A star B is A plus B, and that A inverse is minus A. This particular notation is used a lot when you have groups that are commutative. If a group is commutative, you often use plus as your operation, zero as your identity, and minus your group element as the inverse. In our case, we're most likely not going to do this because our symmetries are most of the time multiplicative because you're going to have things that you compose together. If they are transformations, that acts more like a multiplication than like an addition. It's in just in very simple cases that you find commutative things. Then another example is, and this is why it's important to have this non-ambiguous notation, we could have, for example, R taking away the zero element with multiplication. So at this point, we just have the identity is one. We have the normal multiplication, so A star B is AB. And A inverse is just 1 over A. So by removing the 0, we make sure that everything is an inverse. If you don't remove 0, then you have a problem because 0 is not invertible. There is no element that you multiply by 0 and you get 1. But other than that, this forms a group. And in general, you can have n by n matrices. So many of you wrote this already, but you called it GLN something. So if you work with matrices, just as we had to remove 0 here, we're going to remove all the matrices that are not invertible. So we only get the invertible matrices. And this is called GLN. And here you're going to have whatever field you're working on. So for example, GLNR is going to be the set of all the matrices A in M and R. This is just a notation for the N by N matrices, such that the determinant of A is different than 0. And the operation is just matrix multiplication. And the identity element is the identity matrix. And then there's many other things here. So there's SON, UN, SUN, and so on. These are all the matrix groups, which we're going to see most likely on Friday. So I'm not going to go over these things now because there's no point in defining them more than once. Did anyone talk about the circle group? Doesn't seem like, so I'll tell you. So circle group. Now this is a good example because the circle group is a set S1 and it's just the circle in two dimensions. So it's going to be the set of all the X and Y in R2 that satisfy X squared plus Y squared equal one. This is just a set, it's a geometrical object. So how do we make this into a group? How do we multiply two things that are on the circle? Well, the way we do this is we identify X, Y on the circle with a complex number. Z equal X plus IY. So obviously you can go back and forth from X, Y and Z equal X plus IY. So this is an invertible map that takes you from R2 to the complex number. And then we use complex number multiplication. And this works because, so one thing to notice here is that because X squared plus Y squared equal one, the norm of Z as a complex number is one. And now if you have two complex numbers, the norm of Z times W is the norm of Z times the norm of W. And if they're both of norm one, then this is going to be one. So if you multiply things on the circle, they stay in the circle. That's the idea. And since a picture helps a lot better than all this writing, I'm going to show you the other GeoGebra thing that I prepared, which actually shows you the circle and how to multiply things on it. So I'll post this so you can keep looking at it in the meantime. I'll send you the link. So again, I really suggest you actually play with this at the same time as I show you things so you can actually test how this is happening. For this particular one, you can even use it after because it really helps understanding what's happening. Okay, so just to recap, We have the unit circle. We made it make it into the group by identifying its point with complex numbers. They're going to be of the form e to the I theta because they have norm one. And then we just use complex number multiplication and inversion to figure out things. So these are the two points that we have on the circle. We can just move them around in the circle. If we show the inverses, you see that the inverse in terms of complex number multiplication, just 1/z. And geometrically, it's just essentially reflecting along the x-axis. So we're going to have this here is sent down here. This one is sent on there. And one thing to note is that one is sent to itself. And one is going to be our identity. And if you see what happens to the product, when you move things around, you notice that if z is one, then z times w is the same as w. You can move it around and it doesn't matter. And if you choose w equals z to the minus one, then you're going to end up with one as the product, which makes sense, which means z to the minus one is indeed the inverse. So this is a way to make something geometric into a group. And as it turns out, this is actually something that's important for Lie groups. And again, we're going to see these things later, but Lie groups have this property that they are groups and they're also geometrical objects. So this is actually done for a large class of things and those are Lie groups, but we'll deal with those later. Okay, so at this point, we're going to need the notion of a subgroup. Now, luckily, the notions that I'm going to talk about in the next couple of slides, you should all be familiar with already. So this is the equivalent. Of a subspace. Of a vector space. So a subgroup is just some subset H over group that satisfies these three things. It contains the identity element. If you multiply two things in H, they stay in H, also known as closed under the operation. And if you invert an element of H, it stays inside H. So this means that if you restrict everything to H, you still have a group because everything that you can do in the big group, you can do it in the smaller one without going out of it. And the notation is this one usually. You use a lesser equal to mean a subset of something. I did not invent this notation. That's what people use. So we're going to use it too. And one thing to notice about vector spaces, as it turns out, vector spaces are groups. If you recall what the definition of a vector space is, there's a bunch of axioms, and a subset of those axioms are exactly the group axioms that we had before. There is a special element, which we call zero, that's the identity element. You can sum two things and they stay in the vector space, that's the operation. And for every number, for every vector, you can have an inverse vector, which you can sum to it to get zero, that's the inverse. So vector spaces are actually groups with extra stuff added on top, which is scalar multiplication in a way that it plays nicely with the other operation, which is why all these examples about vector spaces are going to work here too, because technically they are special cases of the definitions I'm giving you right now. Okay, so this exercise, we're going to do all the exercises at the end because I tested it this morning and if I just do this in between, we're not going to have enough time to do things. So for now, some things to notice, you're going to prove this later. The identity element is unique. So even though, so these are things about groups, not necessarily subgroups. Even though I just told you there is an element that satisfies the property, if there is one, that's it, there's only one. You cannot have two identities. And the inverse is unique. You cannot have two inverses of a certain object. Also, if you take the inverse of an inverse, you get back to the same thing, which is reasonable. And this is an interesting one. You know it already from matrix multiplication, but if you take the inverse of G times H, you need to swap the order of G and H before you invert them. And while it may look like something weird, then you might have been wondering for years now, why do we do this for matrices? You can actually prove that this must be the case. Based on the axioms you have, this is the inverse of G times H. There's no other way around it. So that's why it's not just we define the inverse to be this. It's the only way the inverse works. So we're going to work on these problems later. And again, if you need to stop me and you have questions, do that, please. And now we're going to have a notion which is extremely important, especially for when we get to representations, which is the notion of a group homomorphism. And again, I'm going to be doing this for the next few slides. This is equivalent to something about vector spaces. So this is equivalent to linear maps. Homomorphisms are nothing weird. They're just maps that preserve structure. So if you have two groups, G and H, and we have a map between G and H, we say that this is a group homomorphism if this happens. If we take the product of two things in B using the operation in G, I'm explicitly writing the G here so we know that's the operation in G, and then you apply the map phi to them, that's the same as applying phi to A, applying phi to B, and then multiplying them. So you can multiply before or after. So this is something that you can do with homomorphisms that is not necessarily true for any map. So if it is true, then we say it's a homomorphism. And this is equivalent to say that phi preserves the group structure. Now, this is something that happens all the time. Linear maps are the equivalent for vector spaces because being linear means that they preserve the vector space structure. They preserve addition, they preserve scalar multiplication. And in fact, the fact that they preserve addition means that they are the group homomorphism for addition. Then on top of that, they also preserve scalar multiplication. Or for example, if you have an Hilbert space, you have an inner product, it's not just linearity that you need, you also need to preserve the inner product. That's what makes a transformation unitary. So this happens a lot, and so it's important to have this notion of homomorphism, which in fact is used in general. That's why we specify group homomorphism. This is the version for groups. Vector spaces homomorphisms, they're called linear maps because otherwise it's too long. There's algebra homomorphisms and homomorphism, lots of things. Okay, so the exercise that we're going to go over later is for a homomorphism, these additional things happen. Just by using this definition, you get these extra properties for free. Phi of the identity in G is sent to the identity in H. Now, this makes sense, but you may wonder, why don't I have to require this explicitly? You don't have to do it, it just happens. And you've seen this already, by the way, for vector spaces, just by requiring linearity, it just so happens that zero is going to be sent to zero. The zero vector is sent to the zero vector by a linear map. Same idea here. But also the inverse is sent to the inverse in the sense that phi of the inverse of G is the inverse of phi of G. So you can pull out the inverse of the function. And this is extremely important when we deal with representations. Now, all these things that I'm asking you to prove later, they're all extremely easy once you have all the pieces. So everything that's inside here, you can use to prove these things. You need to go and use external material to prove these things. In this sense, they're easy. Okay, so at this point, let me give you an example. Actually, I'll give you the example later when we do isomorphisms.
Giuseppe, Joseph wants to do a question, so I'm gonna unmute him.
Can you repeat that?
There is a question here.
Yes.
Joseph, please.
Is it necessary for G and H to be two different groups, or can there exist a homomorphism within a group?
Okay, that's a great question. So do G and H have to be different groups? They do not have to be different groups. They are arbitrary groups. When I say G and H, let it be groups, it can be anything you want. So in particular, it can be G and G itself. In fact, there's a special name for those. They're called endomorphisms if they go from G to itself. Doesn't really matter for us, that's a special name for them, but it's very important for other reasons. We don't really care too much about those. They're not going to be very important for our purposes, but yes, it can be the same. Okay, so I'll give you examples after we see the next thing, because I can do an example that covers both things. Okay, so okay, maybe like the next two things. I forgot about the slide. You are also familiar with this because you've seen it for vector spaces, but we're going to define the kernel of a homomorphism. So if you have a group homomorphism, phi that goes from G to H, the kernel of this map is just a set of all the points, G in capital G, that are sent to the identity. Same idea as the kernel of a linear map, you might know it also as a null space. And the idea is, if you have elements in the kernel of a linear map is all the elements that are sent to zero, but zero is the identity for a vector space. And one thing to notice, because of the property that I told you about earlier, so phi of EG equals EH, the identity is mapped to the identity, this means that EG belongs to the kernel of phi. So this means that the kernel is never empty. There's always at least one thing inside the kernel. Okay, so now this is a very important proposition, which by the way is true also for vector spaces. It's the same exact thing as vector spaces. If you have a group of homomorphism, it is injective if and only if the kernel is trivial. So the only thing that's in the kernel is the identity of G. And I'm actually going to prove this because it's not difficult. So the idea is simple. Let's go one direction first. So if we prove the implication first, if F phi is injective, at most one thing can be sent to the identity. That's the idea of injective. Everything in the codomain, well, everything in the range, comes from at most one place. You cannot have two things sent to the same object, which means, because we already know that EG belongs to the kernel, this means that the kernel equals the singleton of EG. So this one was easy. If it's injective, only one thing can be sent to the identity, and we already know the identity is sent to the identity. The other way around is a little bit trickier, but not even that much. Okay, so now let A and B be two things in the group, such that phi of A equals phi of B. Now, before we go on, let's make it clear what we're doing. Remember that being injective means that if you have two elements that are sent to the same thing, they must be the same. So that's what we want to prove. If you prove that given these assumptions, A and B must be the same, then we prove that it's injective because A and B are arbitrary. Guys, we know that phi of A equals phi of B. But phi of A equals phi of B means if we multiply both sides by phi of A inverse, for example, this means that EH equals phi of A inverse times phi of B. This is something you can always do with groups. You know how when you're dealing with equations, you multiply and divide by stuff? Because everything is an inverse, you can always multiply and divide by something. So that's what we're doing. And at this point, we use all these properties because the identity of H is now going to be phi of A to the minus one. We can pull the minus one inside the function times phi of B. But then we can pull the multiplication inside. So this becomes phi of A minus B, A minus one times B. But this means that A minus one times B belongs to the kernel because it's sent to the identity. That's the definition of the kernel. But there's only one thing in the kernel. The kernel only has the identity. So this means that A minus one B equals the identity, which means that A equals B. So this means that a group of monophysism is injective if and only if the kernel is trivial. So this is the same proof, by the way, as the linear case, because it's exactly the same. Just you're going to have plus and minus instead of to the minus one, multiplication becomes sum, identity zero, but the proof is exactly the same. That is actually the only thing I want to prove today. Everything else you're going to be proving in the exercises. Okay, so this is really the last thing we're going to do before I send you to the exercises. And there's a definition of isomorphism. And guess what? It's the same as the vector space version. An isomorphism between two groups G and H is just an invertible group of monophysism. And we say that two groups G and H are isomorphic, and we denote it this way with this symbol, if there is such a map. So if you can find an invertible group of monophysism between two groups, then you say that the groups are isomorphic. And of course, we say an invertible group of monophysism and an isomorphism because there can be more than one. No one said there's only one of them. If there is one, generally there's a lot more. And the idea is, just as vector space isomorphisms, the idea is that you can go from one group to the other and back, that's the invertible part, in a way that preserves the structure. And I think my camera is stuck again. Can everyone still hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you, but your camera is just stuck.
Yes, okay.
Now
it happens. It happens every once in a while, so that's why I'm checking. My camera is not great. Okay, so that's the idea of isomorphism. I don't want to go too much into details because hopefully you know what an isomorphism is and what it entails. So I'm going to show you an example of an isomorphism. Now, this is a really good example. So we're going to consider, not just because I came up with it, it's good because we're going to use it later when we talk about the groups. We're going to consider the two groups R with addition and the positive real numbers with multiplication. So these are two groups. This one we've seen already. The other one is actually a subgroup. Of R minus zero, the multiplication. So this is also an example of a subgroup. It's a subgroup because if you take all the non-zero real numbers, but you just look at the positive ones, if you multiply two positive numbers together, they stay positive. If you invert, if you take the reciprocal over the positive number, it stays positive. Zero is not in there. So it's going to be closed under multiplication, under inverse, and the identity, which is one, is positive, so it's in there, so this is a subgroup. So we have these two groups, and then we're going to consider the map exponential that goes from R to R greater than zero. So we're going to take X in R, and we're going to send it to e to the X in R greater than zero. So we're all familiar with this particular map, and it has these properties. First of all, it's invertible. We can just use the logarithm to invert it, and because the output is always positive, you can fit it into the logarithm without problems. And the other property it has is that the exponential of x plus y is the exponential of x times the exponential of y, which means it's a group homomorphism. And so this means that R plus is isomorphic to R greater than zero for multiplication. Now, this result is cool for many reasons. One of them is it allows us to go to something that's an additive group to something that's a multiplicative group. So you can do this often. So whenever you have something that's additive, not necessarily all the time, but often you can make it into something that's multiplicative instead, if you prefer to work multiplicative things. The other reason why this is cool is that the exponential map is actually a very important map that we're going to use when we talk about Lie groups and Lie algebras. And this particular map is an example of the map we're going to see later. So remember this example because we're going to get back to it. Okay, so at this point, I think I talked long enough, and you can actually try the exercises. So before we do this, one thing that I should note, this exercise asks you to use Z2, the group of integers modulo 2. If you don't remember what it is, the file that I sent you the other day, and it's in the Google Drive, so actually let me show it to you. It's here in the notes. There was a review document that I wrote. There is the definition that you need at some point in here. So in this example, you have the exact definition of what's happening. So if you don't remember what the group of integers modulo 2 is, just look it up here. Okay, so you can find all of these exercises in the document that I posted before. I'm going to be dividing you into breakout rooms, so you can work in groups to prove things about group theory. And yes, the pun was intentional. So one last thing I want to tell you is I'm going to send you back to the room just before the end, because it's something else I wanted to tell you. There's a feedback poll that I wanted to ask you to fill at the end. And one other thing, you should have got an email that I sent you earlier about a drop-in Zoom session that I created for after the meeting. So we had to finish the meeting exactly at 3:30. So as soon as we finish the meeting, I'm going to start the other Zoom meeting. If you have any questions, you just want to drop in and talk and you don't want to be recorded while you do that, you can just drop in and ask me things as you would at the end of a real lecture. And of course you don't have to, if you just want to take a break before the next lecture, do that. Just an option in case you want to. Okay, so I'm going to start the breakout rooms. Once you're in the breakout rooms, if you need help, you can just ask for help. There's a button there. And try to work together with your colleagues to actually solve these problems. That's the fun part. If you just do them on your own, what's the fun in that? Okay, so let me see how to do breakout rooms.